With plentiful rainfall and rivers, Pennsylvania is primed for more hydropower to come online. But some worry increased activity will take away from a natural resource that's just bounded back.
To the gentleman that's up there, yeah, definitely looks like he's doing a little catfishing. This is his Yosemite. Why should we take that away from him? And he should have a voice.
I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, our Headwater series continues as we tap into the role of hydropower in our region. Plus, river transportation on the Ohio is big business, but it depends on aging infrastructure.
You look at future economic investment. I don't think anybody in this country would take a 100-year-old foundation and build a new home on it.
And President-elect Trump has chosen someone to head the Environmental Protection Agency, a man who's currently suing it. That story and more on this week's Allegheny Front. Stay with us. The search is on for more sources of clean energy, and one place to find it could be on the Ohio River. The Ohio and its tributaries might become a hotspot for new hydropower development, not by building big new artificial lakes, but by using the region's extensive network of navigation dams. As part of our series, Headwaters, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier explains that not everyone wants to take the hydro plunge.
Behind a chain-link fence, Paul Jacob watches water spill over a dam on Neville Island on the Ohio River near Pittsburgh.
Our project will be just in the water.
The water forms a white froth at the base of the dam, called the Emsworth Back Channel, before flowing into the brown waters of the Ohio. To Jacob, that froth looks like opportunity.
If you look out and you'll see all the water that's flowing over that dam, that basically is unused energy.
Jacob is with Rye Development, a company that's proposed building a small hydropower plant at Emsworth and 9 other dams in western Pennsylvania and West Virginia. If approved, the projects could come online by 2019. Emsworth is part of the Army Corps of Engineers' extensive system of dams along the Ohio and Mississippi River systems. And from Jacob's perspective, these rivers contain a wealth of untapped power.
It's wasted energy that's created by the fact that you've got a substantial flow of water and the difference in elevation of the water. What we do is capture that in a turbine, so it basically spins a giant turbine relatively slowly, and then that spins a generator, and that produces the electricity.
The amount of energy these projects can create isn't enormous. The Emsworth Dam could power only 6,000 to 12,000 homes. That's a tiny fraction compared to the million or so homes a big coal-fired power plant or a hydro plant at Niagara Falls can produce. But even at this scale, these projects can benefit the economy and the environment, Jacob says.
It's a carbon-free resource. So once this is built, it'll just operate. The life of these projects is extremely long compared to most other resources. So it makes a good contribution in terms of adding a renewable resource that's also available on a 24/7 basis.
That last part is important. Wind and solar don't always produce electricity when the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine. So adding reliable sources of power is a big push for people trying to get more renewables onto the grid. Fast-growing wind and solar may garner a lot of attention, but hydropower is still the biggest source of renewable energy in the country, accounting for 7% of all electricity in the U.S.
I think that often it's, you know, talked about as the silent renewable.
David Zayas is with the National Hydropower Association. He says hydropower has been around for so long, some people assume there's no room for it to grow. But the Department of Energy says the industry could grow by 50% over the next 3 decades.
You know, the myth of that hydropower is all tapped out, and that, you know, I think Pennsylvania is a really good example of that not being the case.
With its plentiful rainfall and dammed up rivers, the Keystone State is well suited for hydropower development, says Lindsay Baxter of the Pennsylvania Environmental Council. She says hydro also fits well with what a modernized grid will look like.
The future of power generation is going to be more distributed, smaller resources that are very low or no carbon emitting. And hydro feeds into that and could be very complementary to some of the other resources like wind and solar.
Baxter's group is pushing for more hydropower, but it doesn't want big new dams that can wipe out habitat or displace homes and businesses. Instead, Baxter thinks building projects onto existing dams makes the most sense.
That's really where we see more of the opportunity, where you have a previously disturbed environment sometimes those can be retrofitted to produce power with very little or no impacts on the environment.
Actually, some worry new hydropower plants, even on existing dams, could be bad for rivers. On a recent afternoon, Rob Walters took me on a cruise up the Allegheny River, a few miles from where it flows into the Ohio.
A few times a year, and there is one guy fishing.
Over there.
No, over here to the left, see the white.
Walters is with Three Rivers Waterkeeper. The group monitors water quality on Pittsburgh's rivers, which have slowly seen fish populations increase after decades of industrial pollution. We're idling just below the Highland Park Dam, the site of one of Rye Development's proposed hydroelectric projects. He says this is one of the best spots on the river to fish.
Why are the fish there and not just, like, I don't know, in the middle of the river?
The dissolved oxygen. There's more oxygen concentrated at the dam. It's turbulent.
The dam acts like one of those aerators in an aquarium, infusing the water in this section of the river or pool with oxygen, feeding plants, fish, and other wildlife. A hydropower plant would funnel some of the turbulent water into turbines instead of letting it tumble over the dam. State and federal wildlife agencies say this could drop the river's oxygen levels, which already run low during the summer.
Maybe not specifically in one pool, but the cumulative impact we're talking about, basically every lock and dam on the Monongahela River, the Ohio River, there already is one up on the Allegheny River at the moment. This would be another one.
The developer will need to negotiate with the Corps of Engineers over how much river flow and dissolved oxygen it can divert for the project. But Walters says oxygen isn't all that worries him. He points to a spit of rocks just below the dam. A man sits there on a portable chair. Next to him, a cooler, a bait bucket, and a fishing rod. Walters is worried this spot could get taken out by the hydropower plant, though he doesn't know what the final plan will look like.
To the gentleman that's up there, yeah, definitely looks like he's doing a little catfishing. This is his Yosemite. And why should we take that away from him? And he should have a voice in saying that, you know, every Tuesday afternoon he comes down here with his kids or his grandkids or by himself and he fishes and catches catfish and maybe he takes one home and he eats it.
Walter says he's in favor of clean energy, but he doesn't want it to come at the cost of the region's still recovering rivers and those who use them. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Another well-tested use for western Pennsylvania and northern West Virginia's rivers? Barge traffic. Each year, millions of tons of grain, road salt, and coal move through the region on the inland waterway system. It's considered one of the cheapest and more environmentally friendly ways to move goods, which is great because trains and trucks are nearing capacity. Margaret J. Krause reports, while there's plenty of space for more river traffic, the region's water infrastructure is unreliable at best. At worst, it's devastating.
Deckhands from the towboat D.L. Johnson descend to inspect their cargo, a coal barge. They walk around its edges, the gunnels, to make sure everything looks okay. Then they loop Kevlar lines around the barge's timber heads, and a 40-ton winch aboard the D.L. Johnson pulls the barge snug against the boat. Captain Matthew Baumgartner watches from the wheelhouse.
We move a lot of coal for power plants and steel mills. You know, keeps everybody in electricity and everything.
In Pennsylvania and West Virginia, moving things by water annually generates roughly $8 billion and supports nearly 50,000 jobs, according to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. But it doesn't happen naturally. There's a lot of infrastructure involved. Dams hold back water to create long, navigable pools. Locks allow boats to move from one pool to the next, and together they form a sort of water escalator that allows boats to get over elevation changes. The D.L. Johnson picks up its coal barge just offshore from Congo, West Virginia. But it's here, right below some of the oldest locks on the upper Ohio River, that doing business gets tough. The locks are smaller and crumbling, says Mark Klucheski. He's a project manager with the Pittsburgh District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. By 2028, there's a 50% probability that the Montgomery, Dashiells, or Emsworth locks could fail.
I don't want to say it's a flip of the coin because that sounds trite, but at a 50% probability, that's just as likely to happen as not, and so that makes it kind of terrifying.
It would take about $5 billion to rehab and replace locks on both the Upper Ohio and Lower Monongahela rivers. If a dam went out, it could mean flooding. It could threaten the supply of municipal drinking water, and shipping would grind to a halt.
You'd be able to walk across shore to shore at the point of Pittsburgh and get your ankles wet, and that's it.
Mike Monahan is president of Campbell Transportation, the marine transportation company that owns the D.L. Johnson. It can also build and fix barges. The idea that a lock or dam could go out worries him, but Monahan's also worried about how that would affect the region's long game.
You look at future economic investment. I don't think anybody in this country would take a 100-year-old foundation and build a new home on it.
In this analogy, the 100-year-old foundation is the region's water infrastructure. And the new home?
Building out new petrochemical plants and using all this energy resource that we have with fracking and coal and all the other products we have up here.
But Monahan says if infrastructure remains unreliable, we'll see something very different.
The failure of future economic development for all the people in Western PA.
This summer, Shell Chemical Appalachia announced it would build an ethane cracker plant in Beaver County, a short distance from the shores of the Ohio River near Pittsburgh. The plant will produce the plastic feedstock for everything from auto parts to food packaging.
Shell coming to Pittsburgh is a game changer.
Mary Ann Busey is executive director of the Port of Pittsburgh Commission, which advocates for funding along the port's 200 river miles.
You also have offspring companies that will come in that either need to use your product, sell to Shell, and I think you're going to see that whole petrochemical market increase.
But Busey says it looks like Shell will only be using the waterways during the construction phase, possibly because of reliability issues with the locks and dams. Shell did not return a request for comment. However, if we can update waterway infrastructure, Busey says there's another big avenue of economic potential: moving shipping containers.
It's been successful in every other mode of transportation. There's no reason why it cannot be successful in the inland waterways.
Containers are a high-value business, moving things like electronics. The Port of Pittsburgh is working with other ports nationwide to work out the logistics. Individual companies such as Campbell Transportation are reorienting themselves too. Monahan says the future is coming on fast, and unless the region acts, we'll miss out.
I have a saying, and it's probably a little hokey, but prior proper planning, you know, prevents piss poor performance. And we need to have that planning, and we need to reinvest so we're ready for this world economy.
Well, it will take years, several billion dollars, and some serious coordination. Everyone is hopeful the region can fix its aging locks and dams. Congress is now back on schedule to approve and fund water resource projects. Monahan calls the waterways system a blessing for this country from God. But he says getting around on them, that's up to us. I'm Margaret J. Krause with Keystone Crossroads, reporting for the Allegheny Front.
If you're looking for another perspective on that river commerce system Margaret talked about in her story, meet Ryan Gillerin.
At first, I thought the river was huge, you know, so look at all these trees and different towns. And just, you know, as you see things more and more, it becomes a lot smaller. A lot of trees. I see a lot of trees.
Gillerin is a towboat deckhand, or towboater. He helps get the stuff on barges to where it needs to go. And it's hard, unsung work.
I'll drop off to some power plants, and I just find it interesting that, you know, it'll be 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm there delivering coal, so there's power. No one really ever sees that.
You can hear more about Gillerin's job and see it, too, in a short documentary video at our website. This is all part of our Headwaters series, exploring the resources of the Ohio River in partnership with West Virginia Public Broadcasting. It's all at AlleghenyFront.org/headwaters. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. That's not just the lyric in a holiday carol. It's what H. Sterling Burnett of the Heartland Institute said when he heard about President-elect Trump's pick to head the Environmental Protection Agency. The Heartland Institute is a conservative and staunchly anti-climate science group. Trump's choice is Scott Pruitt. Attorney General of Oklahoma, and a fierce critic of EPA regulations and the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan. Many environmental groups and others are outraged over Pruitt's nomination. Michael Brune, executive director of the Sierra Club, said it's, quote, like putting an arsonist in charge of fighting fires. Joe Wirtz is a reporter at State Impact Oklahoma, where he reports on the intersection of government, industry, and natural resources. Joe, what's Pruitt's track record as attorney general in Oklahoma, and why is it causing such vehement reactions?
So shortly after Pruitt was elected attorney general here in Oklahoma, he started this unit within his office called the Federalism Unit to do, as he describes, to fight against the federal government, to fight against its overreach, and to fight back against unwarranted regulation. So he's, you know, really made it a mission to push back against the Obama administration and the EPA, push back against environmental regulations, climate change rules. You know, he really sees these rules and these regulations that have come from the EPA in the last few years as an overstep.
Pruitt's been a leader in the court case to stop the federal Clean Power Plan, the Obama administration's signature climate policy that limits carbon emissions. And he has been described as having a close relationship with the oil and gas industry. How does that translate into how he might run the Environmental Protection Agency?
He's really been a principal architect of this sort of concerted legal effort from attorneys general in other states to put up a legal fight against Obama and against the EPA. You know, he has very close ties to the fossil fuel industry. Oil and gas is the number one industry here in Oklahoma, and oil and gas are big supporters of him as far as political contributions go. And, you know, he's collaborated with oil and gas companies to push back against the EPA, which is unusual. The oil and gas companies have signed on as parties in his lawsuits. And, you know, in some cases, New York Times investigation showed that, you know, he was taking talking points from the industry. And Pruitt has been unapologetic about that, saying, look, it's a big interest. They're one of the parties that's affected by these EPA regulations. And I'm not ashamed to work with them and fight for them.
Right. Attorneys general are often the enforcers of environmental regulations and protections.
That's right.
So how could, you know, his actions in the past foretell what might happen at EPA over the next 4 years?
Well, it remains to be seen. Clearly, a lot of people see this pick as a crystal clear signal that Trump intends to tear apart a lot of Obama's environmental legacy. He's somewhat limited on what he can do and what he can undo, you know, that's already on the books. But, you know, he could have a lot of power to slow roll and soften the blow of some of these already existing regulations and to block new ones coming down the pipeline. There are people here in Oklahoma that say, you know, Pruitt does, you know, have a history of tackling complicated issues. There was a big sort of water fight in Oklahoma that had a lot of powerful parties with different interests, cities and in the state and Indian tribes, you know, supporters here say that he was good about listening and building a consensus from all these different parties.
Is it fair to call him a climate denier?
He certainly cast doubt on climate change, certainly said that the verdict is not entirely in.
What chance, if any, does the Clean Power Plan have of surviving?
That's a great question. I mean, its fate is still in the hands of the Supreme Court. Pruitt has sued the EPA and certainly joined lawsuits against the EPA over the Clean Power Plan, over regional haze. Some of those attempts have been unsuccessful and some have gained traction. He's given a lot of testimony before Senate subcommittees and up on Capitol Hill, done a lot of interviews against the Clean Power Plan, against the EPA. He's an opponent, to be sure.
Besides being against the Clean Power Plan, what other pro-industry and what might be seen as anti-environment stances has he taken over the years?
He's certainly been critical of U.S. Fish and Wildlife and endangered species designation and you know, threatened species designation, been critical of methane rules and regulations. That matches other areas that he's pushed back against the federal government on Obamacare, on other issues like that. So he has a long track record of fighting the feds. That's really made him popular among conservatives. He'll fight the feds in any arena that, you know, that he can.
But now he's going to be the feds.
Now he's going to be the feds. I mean, he's essentially going to be picked, pending Senate confirmation, of course, to lead the very agency he's sort of made a name for himself fighting. You know, it remains to be seen what it's going to, you know, what it's going to look like. I think some of it will depend on how these court cases come out. But, you know, his supporters say he's a reformer. He comes from a very specific legal perspective, you know, he's bound by the law, even if he does have a different interpretation of it, and knows that in order to get the result he wants, he's going to have to build a consensus. And that means bringing a lot of people and a lot of parties to the table. It'll be interesting to see how big that table is and who's invited to it.
Well, Joe, thanks.
Thank you.
Joe Wirtz is a reporter at State Impact Oklahoma. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Now, we've been talking to people inside the environmental movement about their hopes and fears for the future since the presidential election. Larry Schweiger heads up Citizens for Pennsylvania's Future, or Penn Future. And on their website, here's what he said about Scott Pruitt's nomination to lead the U.S. EPA. Quote, "We are prepared and ready to continue our fight on a clean energy economy at the state level. Penn Future is more energized than ever to ensure that every citizen in the state has access to clean air and clean water while making renewable energy a priority." I talked with Schweiger recently here at our studio.
One of your issues that Penn Future tackles is converting our fossil fuel system into a more renewable system, that being one way to fight climate change. Penn Future is a statewide organization. You work in Pittsburgh, you work in Harrisburg, and all the counties in between. And what we've been hearing, a lot of people in rural places that went red, voted for President-elect Donald Trump, felt left out of the economy, felt disenfranchised. And here in Pennsylvania, what does that mean for some of your initiatives that incorporate the environment and the economy, like renewable energy or fracking?
We're working on both sides of this issue. One, to address the risk of fracking, particularly in communities where we locate these wells next to residential areas where people are exposed to high levels of methane and other contaminants. We also are looking at ways that we can help the mining community transition to the future. We've been lobbying for a federal program. In 1977, there was a mining law passed that put a 10-cent charge on coal, and that money has been building up over the years. We think it ought to be redeployed in large part to help these mining communities make that transition. But beyond that, clean energy, wind and solar, and all the other technologies that are folded into the clean energy economy need to be advanced, and I think we ought to be retooling, particularly the mining employees, the miners, to do some of this work. They can install solar panels if they're properly trained. They can do a lot of these things. And it's important that we move on and recognize that while coal has served the nation well, you know, for hundreds of years, it's now time to go to a new place because we've hit the limits of how much we can put in the sky.
But how do you get that message across to those people who are working in coal jobs or want to go back to coal jobs?
There's this myth that clean energy has caused the coal industry to collapse, when in fact it's not clean energy. It's the gas industry that has rapidly expanded with low-cost frack gas. That's part of the problem. And the other part of the problem is that we celebrate the number of jobs available in fracking and in gas, but we don't recognize that we're seeing a rapid increase in the number of jobs in the clean energy world. I think we need to be shifting our message to look at what's changing in our world. And what's changing our world is that solar costs are coming down dramatically, wind costs are coming down as the size of the turbines scale, as we learn more about how to manage these two new energy sources. So yes, we need to talk about the fact that this makes economic sense as well as it makes environmental sense. It's not about one against the other. It's about a, you know, double bottom line in this case.
Are you going to be changing anything about your organization or how you're mobilizing based on the election results, or are you going to be staying the same course as you would have if Hillary Clinton had become president?
We're not going to reinvent the organization in terms of where we're headed. I think what we have to do is to help target these constituency groups that voted for Barack Obama that did not vote for Hillary. I do believe that it's important for us to be reaching to the right. I think that's something, as a former Republican committeeman, I have you know, I know what the Republican Party used to look like, and I hope at some point we can help draw them back to a place where they can be like former Senator John Hines was, you know, a very concerned environmental leader as well as someone who represented the Republican Party. I hope that we can somewhere meet in the middle.
What other Trump administration policies besides climate change will you be watching?
We're concerned about what the administration might want to do with public lands. The U.S. is blessed with, you know, just incredible public lands in the West and in Alaska, to a certain extent here in the East. And those lands need to be carefully managed according to the original intent. I mean, there's a growing chorus of folks who would like us just to give away our public lands to the states or to the ranchers that have been leasing these public lands for years. That's not appropriate. It's not the right thing for us to do. Our public lands need to remain public, and so we're going to be paying close attention to how that's handled. There's been a discussion of retreating on the wetlands protection provisions in the Clean Water Act. Speaker Paul Ryan, for example, put it at the top of his list. The U.S. Congress back in 1972 passed the Clean Water Act overwhelmingly with the Section 404 to protect wetlands, because at that time they understood that by creating and protecting these wetland buffers, you could keep the water in the rivers and drinking water safer and cleaner by filtering out the pollutants. Wetlands have an enormous value to downstream communities because they buffer storms, they capture nutrients, and they keep the waters clean.
You've been working on environmental issues for a long time. What have you learned over that time that gives you hope, or maybe at least has helped prepare you for the next 4 years for this Trump administration?
Let's start with the American public. I believe very strongly that most Americans are concerned with the proper care of their air, their water, the special places in their life, and are concerned about their children's future. I think that is a common theme, and it's time that the American voters not just vote on Election Day, but become much more engaged. And I'm hopeful that that will happen. You know, we saw that back in the Reagan administration when James Watt was Secretary of Interior, and he had a belief that public resources ought to be sold to the highest bidder. He was very active in undermining the traditional programs in Washington. And the American people welled up and demanded change. And so President Reagan was able to respond to that by dealing with the ozone hole and ended up becoming the president that called for the elimination of lead in gasoline, something that he was originally opposed to. So I've seen it before, and I'm hopeful that with enough public pressure, this administration, the incoming administration, will in fact reshape its promises to fit reality, will reshape its promises to address these concerns. But it's up to us, and it won't happen if we don't speak up.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Larry Schweiger is president of Citizens for Pennsylvania's Future. There are more reactions from environmental leaders on how a Trump presidency might impact the environment and their goals. Those conversations are at our website under politics. That's AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to this week's show. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsoppel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation.